Great. Well, thank you, everyone, for joining us. And at this point, it's 5 minutes after 9, and we are going to go ahead and get started. It's possible that over the next few minutes, we may have a few other people dialing in. Just as a reminder, star 6 will mute your line. Pressing star 6 will also unmute your line. And this is Dr. Joseph Kim, founder of nonclinicaljobs.com, and I'm happy to have with us tonight Dr. Stephen Peskin. And the format for tonight, this is the way that we had it set up. We will actually start with me just giving a very brief introduction and then allowing Dr. Stephen Peskin to answer some questions based on careers in the pharmaceutical industry, and we'll have a dialogue for about 20, 25 minutes. After that, we will open it up for questions, and so those of you in the audience will have the opportunity to ask questions. And given that this call is being recorded, you have the option either to just indicate your name or to just tell us, you know, take 10, 15 seconds to just explain a little bit about who you are, whether you are a graduate of medical school in the United States versus internationally, if you have subspecialty training versus someone who's just done partial residency or no residency. And that kind of information will help set the stage as you answer your question, and then it'll give us an opportunity to respond and answer. So it is our hope and our desire to give plenty of time towards the end for question and answers. So in the meanwhile, just as a reminder, please make sure that you dial star 6 if you anticipate background noise, and just to you know, for the courtesy of others. So and meanwhile, what I will do right now is I think everyone's had a chance to read the biography of Dr. Stephen Peskin, and you know, before you sign up for this call, you were able to see that he is currently the Executive Vice President as well as Chief Medical Officer for all divisions of MetaMedia USA, and he has served in multiple roles across a number of different companies, and so I don't want to go into depth with his background here over the phone because you can read that on the website, but without any further ado, I just want to introduce Stephen and thank him for being on the call. Stephen, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure, Joe. Thank you.
So tonight, you know, one of the common questions that comes up is regarding careers in the pharmaceutical industry. You know, what are some of the ways where people can break in, especially for those who have zero background experience working in the pharmaceutical industry? Perhaps they've just been in clinical medicine. Perhaps they've just done a partial residency. And so we're going to sort of tease apart different audience groups, but I guess starting with the physician who's been out in practice, say, 5, 10, 15 years or so, maybe they are practicing internal medicine or family medicine or even a certain subspecialty. Can you just comment as to what kinds of opportunities exist for physicians who would fall into that category?
Sure. Someone who has been out in practice for a number of years, 5, 10, 15 years, will have a more expanded set of opportunities than someone who has not completed residency training or has completed medical school and has elected not to do any residency training. Certainly someone in a subspecialty, there are companies that are particularly keenly interested in individuals with subspecialty training, and that's fairly straightforward, should be fairly straightforward to anyone on the call because they have a substantial amount of their work in a particular therapeutic area, certainly respiratory disease at GSK with Advair being one of the leading brands in the world, and that type of thing would be the way that you could benchmark yourself to that particular company. Someone who's been in practice for 5 to 10 to 15 years will undoubtedly have had various levels of interaction with individuals, certainly professional sales representatives. Perhaps you've had interaction with district managers. Perhaps you've had interaction with marketing people from pharmaceutical companies participating on advisory boards, focus groups, that sort of thing, in the context of dinner meetings or lunch and learns in your office. So those opportunities have given you the chance to meet individuals in the pharmaceutical industry, and then you have the ability to use those relationships to your advantage to going to those companies and then saying that I'm interested potentially in a career in the pharmaceutical industry. Now, I would suggest to anyone in that situation to be much more focused than what I just described, that you're just broad brush interested, and that's kind of what we're going to get into on this call today, to really be able to tease out or delineate what are those kinds of positions that would be of interest to you and why they would be of interest to you. I'd also say that one of the things that makes people in the pharmaceutical industry a bit nervous about physicians who have been in practice 5, 10, 15 years, and certainly the more years in practice, the more potentially this is problematic, in that as a physician in practice, you are the captain of the ship. It is typically a very hierarchical relationship in the office, where the physicians own the practice or in charge, and the medical technicians, nurses, nurses' assistants, the office staff are working for you, with you, but for you. Entering into corporate America, the pharmaceutical industry, or for that matter, IBM or Intel or Google or Microsoft or anywhere else, you are in a very different environment. You're not going to be the boss. And so companies really need to understand, and you need to make it clear that you understand that you're going to be working for someone, and you're going to be working with people who are certainly going to respect and appreciate your intellect and your clinical knowledge that you bring to the equation, and potentially some additional scientific knowledge. That said, that it is not a relationship where you are sort of the boss or talking down to or directing or giving directives, start this IV or swab this area or what have you. So I think that's very important for people in clinical practice 5, 10, 15 years to realize. The opportunities for people that have been in practice might include a field-based position to break in, and those field-based positions are often called regional medical research scientist or medical science liaison. These are individuals who work for pharmaceutical companies, oftentimes PharmDs, sometimes PhDs, and sometimes MDs, who are in some ways the clinical face or voice of the pharmaceutical company to academic health centers, to physicians in practice, and especially to physicians who are very important to that pharmaceutical company because they are working as investigators or sub principal investigators on clinical trials, or they're individuals who have a lot of what we call outbound influence in the biz. So there's a notion of inbound and outbound influence. If you're an outbound influencer, you are a physician who other physicians listen to in your local, regional, or sometimes nationally as well. So that's one opportunity, Joe, is in that role of a scientific liaison. Another way that you might break into the pharmaceutical industry as someone who's been in practice 5, 10, or 15 years is to be in the corporate office in medical affairs. Those roles can also be working on, as a corporate person, working with the product teams around their relationship with physicians and influential physicians. That work can also include working with the product team, reviewing information, or in Dr. Kim's world, in my world, what we call content. So you can be a physician looking at it with a critical eye from the standpoint of medical accuracy, from the standpoint of scientific accuracy, and from the standpoint of, quite honestly, believability. You put yourself in the role of the physicians who are going to be receiving this information and saying, wow, this is really over the top, or this is really not believable, not credible, or this should be said or described in a different way, or that's something that a doctor would never say to a patient, that sort of thing. So that can be another role for someone who's been in practice for a period of time. If you have subspecialty training, in particular things like oncology, right now rheumatology is very, very hot because of all the anti-tumor necrosis factor alpha and interleukin blockers and so forth. They're used in rheumatoid arthritis and inflammatory conditions. So certain subspecialties are in particular demand.
Stephen, thank you so much for that great explanation. And I think that everything you said really resonates with people who have been out, like we started the discussion, you know, people who've been in practice for 5, 10, maybe 15 or so years. What about for those young physicians? Maybe they did half a year of residency or a year of residency, or maybe they're an international graduate who lives now in the United States. They have no residency training. What about for people like that who don't have board certification, full residency training? What kinds of ways can they break into the pharmaceutical industry?
Sure. So that medical degree, that doctor of medicine degree or doctor of osteopathic medicine degree, is still certainly very valued and respected for the 4 or so years that it took to acquire that information about physiology, pathophysiology, pharmacology, and so forth. So that individual might be able to find herself or himself an opportunity in the pharmaceutical industry in more what I would call purely informational and scientific. And there is an area, I believe, that Dr. Kim has talked about on his nonclinicaljobs.com, pharmacovigilance and safety. So these are individuals that are working for the pharmaceutical company that are reviewing information that comes in from patients and doctors, adverse events. Sometimes they might be categorized as serious adverse events, and that has to be reviewed, evaluated, cataloged and categorized, and well documented. And certainly this is critically important to pharmaceutical companies. If there's any scintilla of possibility that information like this is being not paid attention to, this is where you see some of these huge judgments against the pharmaceutical industry. So there's a tremendous amount of focus and vigor around pharmacovigilance and drug safety. So being a safety officer or being someone involved in that. Another possibility is pharmaceutical companies and also companies like MediMedia do employ physicians and also non-physicians, PharmDs, RPHs, now are PharmDs, and those individuals might be involved in drug information. So you have the scientific knowledge, the medical knowledge, to be able to be on the phone and talking to nurse practitioners, PAs, called advanced practice clinicians, or mid-levels and physicians who are calling in for information. The pharmaceutical companies are looking for individuals with a scientific background to be involved in drug information. So those are opportunities to get a foot in the door. Another possibility for individuals who are MDs or DOs with no or partial training might be to work for a company such as the companies that Dr. Kim and I provide senior physician leadership for. These are companies that work for pharmaceutical companies. So your way to get into the pharmaceutical company is to work for a company that works for the pharmaceutical companies, or you might find that you enjoy being in what is called the services industry. And these are companies that do things such as writing, medical writing. If you've got a penchant for or a strong writer, there are companies that, and it's gotten a bit of a sometimes tarnished reputation. Sometimes it's called ghost writing, but again, this is done with a tremendous amount of rigor. And we have one of these companies within the MediMedia portfolio that writes for, or sort of with, I shouldn't say for, excuse me, writes with the investigators, working shoulder to shoulder, doing some of the analysis, and then certainly some people would need to have advanced skills in doing forest plots or other kinds of writing the materials and methods sections, but these are individuals who help to craft the manuscripts that are submitted to refereed journals, hopefully for acceptance, and these can be for the critical dossier for the pharmaceutical company that gets that drug approved or not approved by the Food and Drug Administration in the European Union. And then it could also be for expanding that product's scientific bibliography. For a pharmaceutical product, the bibliography is a very important sort of backbone or foundation of how that product is positioned and marketed and sold. So that's one possibility. Another possibility are in continuing medical education companies. These are companies that are involved in writing grants. Those grants go to pharmaceutical companies, and then the pharmaceutical companies have physicians and PharmDs and PhDs and nurses that review those grants. If those grants are accepted, then that can be the basis for CME programs, anything from grand rounds to web-based seminars on Medscape and to live programs, CME dinner meetings, which I'm sure many of you on this call have been invited to and have gotten email invitations for, or monographs, CME monographs, that sort of thing. There are other companies that do promotional work for pharmaceutical companies. This promotional work includes education, medical education, non-accredited. Again, this would be things like dinner meetings at a steakhouse, for example, where there's a speaker, or it could possibly be done by video broadcast. We do a number from various studios around the country where the broadcast goes out to multiple sites simultaneously with a nationally or internationally known faculty, but it is not accredited. Other types of non-accredited education could be as simple as lunch and learns that take place in physician offices and that sort of thing. So promotional medical education, another opportunity for physicians without full training, or with full training for that matter, would be in medical advertising agencies. These are the organizations that create the advertising materials, the promotional materials that professional sales representatives take with them, and when they call on or see physicians or nurse practitioners or PAs in offices or in hospitals or in other settings.
Stephen, thank you so much.
Anything you want to add to that or expand on?
You covered a tremendous amount of ground there in the few minutes that you were speaking, and I think I would just like to clarify for the audience a few points. One is that we use this term ghostwriting very loosely, and that phrase has fallen under a tremendous amount of scrutiny over the years. And I think what certain companies used to do as ghostwriting are practices that no longer exist today. For instance, writing up a whole manuscript and then submitting it to a faculty key opinion leader saying, will you please approve this and put your name as the leading author, when that person had nothing to do with the actual manuscript. That kind of ghostwriting practice has stopped, I would say, a number of years ago. And I think today most of these companies provide what I would call editorial support for manuscripts and things like that, with the key intent being that the faculty, the key scientists and the experts in the field are still the ones who are really drafting the manuscripts, coming up with the content, and not these agencies, not these companies drafting them as ghostwriters. So for those in the audience, I just want to clarify that term ghostwriting is an old phrase that has evolved over the years, and I think nowadays most companies would probably like to say that they don't practice ghostwriting, because we're talking about the old days. Sort of another point of clarification is that, Stephen talked about promotional medical education versus CME, continuing medical education. And even that whole industry has really evolved over the years. If you talk to people who were involved in CME 5, 10 years ago, what CME used to be is dramatically different than what it is today. And 5, 10 years ago, CME would have been considered a form of rogue marketing, where the marketing teams, they were using CME to try to push off-label promotion of their products, knowing that they cannot do that kind of off-label promotion using FDA, regulated promotional education needs and advertising agencies and so forth. So CME became the venue and became the tool. Well, today, in this world of CME today, it's dramatically different. And in order to work in the CME space, you actually have, we have zero contact with the pharmaceutical companies. It's not like it used to be 5 or 10 years ago. And so that's just something that I want to make sure that people are aware of, because one of the things that you may get involved in, you'll get involved in talking with people who've worked in these industries, and perhaps those folks were in the industries 10 years ago or longer, and the stories that they may share with you from that time period might be dramatically different from what it is today. So that's just something to keep in mind, but I want to thank you for covering all of that. And it sounds like whether you're talking corporate offices and medical affairs and pharmacovigilance, or whether you're talking about being a field officer and being an MSL or someone out on the field force, there are certain key, what I would call key skill sets that go beyond just the medical training, beyond the scientific knowledge and the scientific expertise that one needs to have in order to really succeed in the pharmaceutical industry. So, Stephen, can you just talk about some of these key, what I would call maybe soft skills, hard skills? You can kind of lump them into whatever category you'd like. But what are some of these skill sets that people need to have in order to really succeed in this industry?
Sure. And just to emphasize what Joe, Dr. Kim said, yeah, the ghostwriting, again, is a term that is outdated and has a very big black eye. So our company that does medical writing with shoulder to shoulder with the investigators, absolutely the thinking has to come from the PIs, sub-PIs, the people writing, and we do editorial and layout and help with some of the statistical analysis, just as CROs, contract research organizations, also help with statistical analysis on clinical trials for the pharmaceutical companies. So it absolutely, and the other thing that Joe mentioned, that just to kind of steep you in some of the lexicon, because I think it's very important when you go on interviews to be, and this is one of the sort of soft skills and kind of one of the reasons people even go to business school at all, is that you know the lingo, just like you know the lingua franca of medicine. Business and pharmaceutical business, they talk about MLR, medical legal regulatory review. So that kind of review, is, as Joe said, is extremely rigorous. DME is totally hands-off. Promotional education is totally hands-on, and by totally hands-on I mean as the medical officers and the lawyers sometimes and the compliance folks have to review everything and re-review it and re-review it. And friends of mine who are medical directors in pharmaceutical companies find this to be one of their more tedious tasks, quite honestly, is going to these RAC or MLR or CCC, copy clearance committee, they call different things at different companies, but having to assiduously review literally every word on a promotional piece before it goes out. So it can be a bit tedious. In terms of the hard skills, certainly being able to write well, and I've seen a lot of physician writing and charts, and having done years ago review for the PRO, the peer review organization, most of you are probably too young to remember the PRO and the Super PRO, but I've seen a lot of pretty abysmal writing. So I would say writing clear, crisp, and concise is a hard skill that I would say is something that corporate America and pharmaceutical companies included are looking for. Being able to effectively communicate verbally or orally as well, whether you call that a soft skill or a hard skill, I'll defer to Joe on that. Again, is it something I mentioned earlier, being able to appreciate that you're working in a matrixed organization, that is, that there are multiple stakeholders or centers of power, if you will, and being able to work in an environment where there are multiple parties that are involved in making a decision, that collaborative kind of environment, a team-based environment. Also, being able to really let others know what you're doing. So that's the old proverbial managing up and managing down. Managing up so that your boss knows that you're on top of things, so that your boss isn't nervous that, you know, what's this person out in the field, physician I haven't heard from in 10 days doing, and why haven't, you know, so that kind of keeping folks informed, critical people, both who work that you work for or that you work with as well. And then certainly if you're in a situation where you're beginning to manage other people, to be able to give those people coaching and feedback and counsel on how they're doing in their job in a positive way, even if it's a negative message, and then certainly also to give people feedback when they've done a good job. I think that's another very important thing that I've talked to people in clinical settings, and you know, the comment that they never heard any word of praise from anybody. I think it's very important in most corporate cultures and organizations to give positive feedback to individuals that you're working with, that may be your bosses or that at some point in your career that are working for you as well.
Great. Thank you, Stephen. Well, yeah, I think those are some excellent points. And what I want to do now is just remind the audience that this is part one of a two-part series, and part two will occur in a few weeks in March, on March 13th at 9 o'clock p.m. It's a Sunday as well. And the point of the splitting of these two calls is that it would take us over an hour to actually go in depth into some of the things that has been mentioned. For instance, the MSL jobs versus the jobs being in medical affairs and doing pharmacovigilance versus working in a CRO or working in a medical education company or an advertising agency or doing things related to marketing and promotion. So the point for the call on March 13th is really to dig deep into some of those specific details and to talk about the specific ways that people can actually learn more about those industries, about the different opportunities that exist in there. Having said that, it certainly doesn't preclude us from allowing you all to have some specific questions that you may want to ask. And we're about to enter the interactive question and answer period now. My request to you, once again, as a reminder, this call is being recorded, so if you feel comfortable, you can use your name. Please tell us a little bit about yourself. If you don't feel comfortable, you don't have to use your name, but still, if you tell us a little bit about your background, it'll help us at least frame the question. Please keep your question short and focused. We will try to do the same when we answer the question, and then we'll try to go on. And so with, you can certainly ask questions specific to one of these industries, but I think Stephen has covered a lot of ground, and it helps to know whether you are someone who have you been in practice for 5, 10, 15 plus years? Are you someone with zero to little residency experience? And what specific areas do you think that you would ultimately see yourself in? So those are some things that I think would help us answer the questions. But at this point, what I will do is open it up for questions, and this is one of those kind of awkward periods where sometimes everyone tries to ask a question at once, other times there's long pauses. If I notice that there is a long pause and no one's asking a question, then there's some several questions that I have that I will continue to ask Dr. Peskin. But in the meanwhile, I wanted to give everyone who's on the line an opportunity to ask your questions. So whoever has a question first can speak up and ask a question now.
This is Heather Bork. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes.
Oh, hi. Thank you so much, Dr. Buffin and Dr. Kim, for doing this. It's excellent information. And I do coaching board positions who want to transition, and just wanted to ask a question on behalf of a client who said I could ask this question for them. Is that okay?
Okay. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. This is a family practice physician who's been in practice about 2 years and had some research experience prior to medical school. They thought they might actually go into research, doing some bench research. So they're interested in the pharmaceutical industry, and they're wondering whether they should try to get more clinical experience under their belt, whether it would be okay to try to transition at this time, and they're looking at pharmacovigilance as an option or the medical science liaison, and just how to, A, look at what you might be happy in, see if they don't want to make a mistake again, and just the nuts and bolts of looking at jobs that might be appropriate and kind of doing the logistical next step thing to getting started, and also seeing if there's other things that might enhance the resume that they should do before they try to make a transition.
Yeah, I'd say off the bat, that's a very strong background. I was talking with a good friend of mine, actually, we were together at dinner last night in New York, and he has had a pretty meteoric rise from academic cardiology into the pharmaceutical industry, started in the field and now has had three promotions in a particular corporation's home office. And one of the things that he said to me was it was critically important for his breaking into the pharmaceutical industry was being a PI or a sub-PI, having an understanding of what pharmaceutical companies go through, the proverbial blood, sweat, and tears around clinical development and clinical research is a great, great thing to have. And I realize your client's background was pre-medical school, was more bench. Even that is something that pharmaceutical companies appreciate, people who have that that experience in research. So I'd say the pre-medical school research combined with finishing medical school, a family practice residency, and being in practice for 2 years is a pretty strong point of entry. One of the things that I didn't mention that I think is very important when Dr. Ken was asking about soft skills and hard skills is, as you look at particular companies, look at in your being talking to headhunters or whatever, make sure, double sure, triple sure that you do your homework, that you know all that you can about that company is what they call in line, which means marketed products that have been approved by the Food and Drug Administration, and also now, thank goodness for search engines and so forth, and all the plethora of information available, what that company's got in development, and then look to match that to your, as you were saying, Heather, to what you're interested in. You know, Joe and I have talked a lot about this over the years, that it is a huge mistake to run away from something. You know, I don't like managed care, I don't like practice, I don't like my partners, I don't like what I'm doing. It is far, far better and will come across in interviews as much as you might try to hide it or in presenting yourself as you want to move towards something. So I think what you said is so important, that you're looking at a job in a situation that is you're excited about and interested in, rather than just something to get out of something else.
Yeah,
Joe, anything to add there?
Yeah, I mean, I think the other key point when it comes to career satisfaction is just the person really needs to be aware of what are the key issues that are causing this person to be dissatisfied, and will those be similar issues? Maybe just they might be different forms of the same issue, but I think people often think that the grass is greener on the other side, and they get on the other side just to realize it's not greener, it's just different. And so, for instance, if you are a field officer as an MSL, you're traveling all the time, you're living out of a suitcase, and that may be very satisfying for some and very unsatisfying for others. The flip side is if you're in a large corporate environment and you've got all these pressures and back-breaking deadlines and really stiff bosses who are not very flexible with you, then that could also be a very miserable environment. So I think the one of the key points that I really try to emphasize is talk to as many people as possible who work in those industries to get a sense of what kinds of things they like and what kinds of things they don't like. Obviously, certain factors you can change from going from one company to the next or possibly being transferred into a different department. But what I often find is that when people talk about the reasons why they're so dissatisfied, the pharmaceutical industry may not really be the right answer for them. So I think those would be the key points that I would emphasize. But great question. Yeah, sure thing. Mm. Anyone else? Who's next? Who has a question that they would like to ask tonight?
Hello?
I can go ahead.
Yes, go ahead.
Can you hear me?
Yes, actually, can you wait for just a minute? There was someone right before you.
Okay.
Thanks. This is Sanjay, and I am a medical graduate from an international medical school. After that, I've done my medical training in neurology, and that was also from an international medical school in India. However, I've done my PhD and my clinical fellowship from a premier institution in Boston, and I'm currently looking at positions in the neurology, neuroscience-related fields, more in the medical devices industry, and would to get some suggestions or some advice on medical affairs or regulatory affairs in the bus industry and how to work finding positions in that aspect.
Yes, absolutely. There are the device industry, companies like Medtronic and Boston Scientific, and there's one, the name escapes me, that's one of the premier neurosurgical medical device companies that's right here. I'm embarrassed, I can't remember the name. It's right here in the Princeton area where I live. So there absolutely are opportunities on the device side. They are fewer than there are in the pharmaceutical and biotechnology industries, but there definitely are opportunities for physicians in the medical device industry. Again, your best opportunities are going to be where you've had some direct experience as a surgeon or interventional cardiologist in the case of interventional cardiology devices, or an electrophysiologist in the case of implantable cardioverter defibrillators or pacemakers or ablation devices in the EP lab. So, there definitely are, and as Dr. Kim was saying, getting to people, peers, colleagues, networking through a friend of a friend of a friend of a friend, if need be, is one of the quintessential things that you need to do. It sounds like your training is phenomenal, MD, PhD, and I would bet you you probably already have a pretty strong Rolodex. So I would encourage you strongly to dive into that Rolodex. Joe, anything else?
Yeah, I think on the device side? Those are really some key points. You know, the device side is an industry that has gone through a significant amount of change recently, and it's probably beyond the scope of this call or beyond the scope of a 3-minute conversation to really go more in depth, given the breadth of background and experience that you have, because we're not necessarily just talking about, for instance, being an MSO or doing something like that. But I think that there are lots of highs and lows in terms of types of positions, and it's important, I think, to really dig into them. So I think there aren't really any more specific feedback that I can give at this point, because it's probably a more lengthy conversation to be had offline. So I apologize for that, but I think, the points that Stephen made were excellent, and beyond that, I wouldn't really add any more to that right now.
Thank you very much.
Sure. All right. So the next person who was going to ask a question, and unfortunately I had to interrupt, you may ask your question now.
Okay. This is Dr. Doshi. I'm practicing anesthesiologist more than 20 years, and I'm trying to divert into non-clinical job. And as an anesthesiologist, I've been talking to a lot of pharmaceutical representatives and trying to explore different options for me. So I would like to ask your input into this. Are there any prospects as an anesthesiologist in the pharmaceutical industry?
There absolutely are. You would certainly be more expert than Dr. Kim or myself as it relates to the various advances in anesthesia, and you would be very I think well served in your looking for a job specifically around those companies that have not only an active, strong presence in the marketplace for products in anesthesia, but also looking at their prospects. So looking at the pipeline, there are companies that are very strong right now, for example, in cardiovascular medicine, that are really moving, and the biggest of them all is Pfizer with the Torvastatin Lipitor goes off patent next year, and that is dramatically changing things at the world's largest pharmaceutical company, and there's less focus in cardiovascular medicine than there was a decade ago. So as you look at the constellation of companies that are active in anesthesia, I would also, you know, definitely look at what their prospects are. And there's a lot of great information from the investment houses, the investment banks, through basic search engines, and going to the websites of the companies that you currently know very well, because they're calling on you, they're talking to you, and kind of seeing what their future prospects are in anesthesia.
Yeah, those are excellent points. I would say that I remember a couple years back, Schering Plough had a neuromuscular reverser, Sugammadex, that was looking really exciting and was a pipeline agent, and then the FDA rejected it. At least this was 2008. I don't know if it's still something that they're actively working on. But as it relates to pipelines, and this really goes across all specialties, regardless of what therapeutic area you're interested in or what your background might be, that most of the opportunities are really going to be in the pipelines. I know an internist who got hired for, you know, one of the major pharmaceutical companies, given all the clinical research that was occurring around the oral anticoagulants, the new oral agents. They are now going to replace warfarin and heparin and so forth. And when you know what's in the pipeline, when you know what's being developed, then those are really where the golden opportunities are. And I would say that there are fewer opportunities with the established products, especially those that are now nearing the end of their product life cycle, nearing the end of their patent life. That's usually when pharmaceutical companies start diverting money away from those branded drugs and more towards the pipeline drugs and the new agents. So just knowing that kind of information about the different pharmaceutical companies, whether it's AstraZeneca, whether it's Pfizer, whether it's Merck, are really key pieces of information that you're going to want to have as you research those companies and research the types of roles, whether they be field-based positions or even corporate office positions. So,
and I think, too, again, someone who's like yourself, who's been in practice for 20 years, you certainly know individuals from companies, and obviously you have to be extremely, extremely politic, because you might not want your hospital or your partners or to have any inkling that you're looking, or maybe you do. That's entirely up to you. But let's just say you're trying to keep this very quiet, so people that you know you can trust that don't have proverbial loose lips to tell, oh, Dr. So-and-so is looking at the jobs outside. Well, gee, that's news to me, and your department chair goes crazy or whatever. So, use those contacts that you do have. It can be a wellspring of information about the company, about the environment, about the corporate culture. The same jobs that we talked about earlier, as an anesthesiologist, you might be a field-based person, as Dr. Chemist Joe was saying, you know, traveling around the country and representing the company in front of other anesthesiologist individuals who were your clinical peers. Now you're in a different relationship with them. You're trying to cultivate them, nurture them to have a very favorable opinion of your company and its products, or you're working with investigators who are working on products that are in clinical development, or you go into the home office and you work in pharmacovigilance or in medical information, or you work as a physician involved in those facets of product marketing where medical affairs, medical officers, medical directors are working with the so-called brand teams or product teams. So those same jobs that we talked about would apply to you in anesthesia as well. It would just be within the field of anesthesia.
Thank you very much.
Great. Does anyone else have any questions that they'd like to ask tonight?
Hi, my name is, this is Lavanya, and I'm a graduate of can I speak? I'm a graduate of the U.S. Osteopathic Medical School, and I did 1 year of training, then I decided not to continue on with residency. I'm actually from the central New Jersey area, and so I'm always running into physicians or people that are in the pharmaceutical industry, and I've talked to numerous people, including recruiters. So what most of them are saying is that the pharmaceutical industry right now is only hiring physicians with prior experience in the industry. So, Dr. Peska, my question for you is it even a good time for someone like myself, who, you know, is not board certified or had any clinical practice, to even try to break in pharma?
Oh, it's always possible. It is a less job-rich environment than it was, say, 12, 15 years ago. That said, the friend that I was with last night, now he did complete training, was board certified, but he had the same issue for those jobs, 3 to 5 years experience in the industry. Well, he had zero. I mean, he's looking to make a change from academic cardiology to the pharmaceutical industry. He had zero experience. He worked with pharmaceutical companies. He worked as a PI and sub-PI. Your situation is certainly a bit tougher than his in terms of kind of where your baseline is. That said, again, as Dr. Kim and I were talking about, there are those safety officer, pharmacovigilance, medical information jobs where you don't need that 3 to 5 years of experience, or you don't need that completing a residency fellowship credential. The other opportunity for you that I would look, and maybe you already are, is looking at the pharmaceutical marketing services companies as a way to get in, and you might find yourself very happy, you know, for a number of years in one of those, and that takes your career down, you know, down that path. So that can be another way that you can bridge to the pharmaceutical industry. There are medical directors that are hired out of publication planning or medical pharmaceutical advertising agencies or promotional medical education companies. If you're working with one of those and those companies see you as someone who can, quote-unquote, be put in front of a client, and some people are perceived by their companies to be able to be put in front of a client, i.e. the drug company, others, for whatever reason, they are perceived as not be good in front of the client, but presumably you're one of those people who would be good in front of the client, and then that gives you exposure to individuals in the pharmaceutical industry and can be a natural bridge and entree into one of the pharmaceutical companies from one of the service companies. And there are also service jobs. We have a group of primarily international medical graduates, not exclusively, that work in a call center that we have, and these are physicians who are called physician advisors. They're doing some medical information. They're doing a lot of what's called e-detailing or video detailing, where they endeavor to break through the office manager, the gatekeeper, what have you, and then spend 10, 12 minutes on the phone with a physician about the product and its pharmacology and its use and MOA and so forth. So those would be, you know, some ways to look at breaking in. Joe, anything to add there?
Yeah, I think I would just reemphasize the fact that given today's contractions that are happening within the pharmaceutical industry, as well as the mergers and acquisitions, globally speaking, I think that there are probably better opportunities, more probable opportunities, if you go to accompany the services of the pharmaceutical industry, so that be it a medical advertising agency, a CME company, a CRO, any of those, I think, because those are still growing, or I should say they have demands that fluctuate. For instance, if they get a major account with Pfizer or with GSK or with Merck, and it's with a brand new product, then all of a sudden they may need to hire 3, 4, 5 medical directors and hire all these writers and so forth. So the workload for those companies are always there's always work to be done, and in a sense, I think that there's greater probability, just broadly speaking. But I think that, as Stephen mentioned, there's always a chance, and there may be ways that you might be able to position yourself and make yourself more competitive compared to someone else. And one significant advantage that I think people who are especially who I'll call younger physicians or people who have less experience are that in general they don't demand as high of a salary as someone who's got, say, 15 to 20 years of experience, especially if that experience is within the pharmaceutical industry. Mm-hmm. And depending on your role, perhaps there are certain things that you can also do that a more seasoned physician can do. But if you're going to cost less to the company, then you might actually have that competitive advantage. That's not always going to work to your favor, but there may be certain roles that that may be the case. So those are also some things you have to keep in mind.
Yeah, another to build on that is the part-time or freelance. So another way to garner that coveted and needed experience is to work as part of a team, and perhaps it's virtually from your home. I know a number of physicians who live around the country and who have honed their writing skills, their medical writing skills, promotional education as well as accredited, and they will work as part-time or freelance individuals. So that's another way to sort of get some of that, you know, desperately needed experience.
Okay.
Right. Great. Well, I think we've got time for one more question, maybe two, and then after that we're going to wrap up just with a few tips on where to go next. So any other questions tonight?
Oh, yes, I have a question.
I'm sorry, I think I heard two people, so I don't know who was first, but just go ahead and start asking your question.
I already asked one question, so you can go ahead. Fine.
Oh, okay. My name is Debbie. I'm an anesthesiologist with 20 years experience, board certified, trained in the U.S. I have a lot of experience with devices. I wrote a lot of 510Ks and went through a lot of FDA inspections for a very small medical device company, but there don't seem to be device opportunities, and I want to know how do you get started in pharmaceuticals, and I'm trying to find some way to, like, leverage my regulatory experience, but it seems like device is so different from pharmaceuticals that I don't know how to do that.
Yeah, I would suggest that your experience is going to be much valued and appreciated, and though a device is not, as Dr. Kamjo was talking about, the factor 10A inhibitor, direct thrombin inhibitor that was recently approved, you know, an area that's exploding right now in the pharmaceutical industry with apixaban and rivaroxaban and edoxaban and dabigatran that was just approved recently for BI. Your you know, kind of knowledge of the rigor and the all of what it takes in terms of documentation, FDA process, which isn't exactly the same but is very, you know, is paralleled, I think puts you in an extremely strong position to take your device experience with this small company and leverage that with small molecules or large molecules. So with the biotech, the monoclonal antibodies, or with small molecule products. So I would think that would be very strong. How do you get started? That's the age-old question, the million-dollar question, as it were. It's being bold and not timid. It's asking people for help. How did you get started? I got started through, you know, making a conscious decision fairly early on in my career, decided to go to business school. That's not mission critical at all. An MBA or an MPH or MHA or MPP or whatever can be, you know, value added, not critical. And looking to potentially shadow someone, you know, someone that you know that would allow you to, with the approval, the appropriate approvals. It does happen. I come into a company. I had a third-year resident, in internal medicine recently spend a month with me, and she thought she might be interested in medical communication and education, so she did that as one of her electives. We have had several other students cycle through PharmDs and MDs and so forth. So that's, you know, that's another way to do it, is to make yourself available. Another way to do it is to get some experience in a, and Joe, we didn't talk about this yet, there are companies that are operating on proverbial fumes that would love to have your help, though they might not be able to pay you much of anything, if at all. So you keep your day job and you throw in some time for that that experience. If you get lucky and that company makes it and starts to make it, then you may you know, join that team. If you don't, which happens more than it doesn't, quite honestly, that these companies fail, you have a potentially very powerful resume builder there. So that's another opportunity to get that experience.
Yeah, I mean, the only other thing that I would add, and I add this because I've actually worked with some people who have gone to the FDA, is to actually consider working for the FDA. Right now, the FDA is going through a lot of reorganization. They're trying to figure out how they can get devices on the market safer and faster. And I think that given your experience, depending on what your goals are in your life, if it's to make a really big salary and to climb the corporate ladder, then the FDA might not be the best place for it. But if it's to escape clinical medicine, to do something on the non-clinical side, and to have a relatively stable career, then I know that a number of people who've gone to the FDA after working clinically for 20-plus years. And so that is another real opportunity right now. As the FDA changes and as they look for more physicians, and especially for those who have this kind of research experience, that may be a real opportunity for you as well. And then after a couple of years,
that is such a good point. I kicked myself on Joe that hit it out of the park. The Food and Drug Administration, it is a government. It is a huge bureaucracy. That said, it is you know, people coming out of FDA at more senior levels honestly can write their ticket in industry. Just as we see people who come out of various key positions in a particular administration go on to be deans of medical schools, or, you know, coming out of senior roles at Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, puts you in the proverbial catbird seat, or coming out of DOD and then going to one of the defense contractors. So the FDA is a great, great suggestion. Another suggestion is to work, and I think Heather is on the phone, and, you know, there are definitely, in addition to using social media, such as non-clinical jobs or LinkedIn, there are, obviously, there are executive search, and you can look in the, whether it be the New England Journal of Medicine or the Journal of American Medical Association or the Annals or Family Practice Journal, and there'll be small little classifieds. So start to, you know, to network through those individuals in those firms as well.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that, Steve. And I think we're getting ready to wrap up here, and I think that you've hit upon some of the key next steps that I was going to emphasize as well. You know, number one is networking. Number two, I would say that as you see these job opportunities popping up on job boards and job listings, your temptation might be to just submit your resume and to just see what happens, you know, throw your hat into the ring and see if you get an interview. I would say that the better approach is really to work with some professional assistants to get your resume really refined, to highlight as much as you can about the skill sets that you have that will be transferable in the pharmaceutical industry, and to really go in there with a strong foot in the door so that you don't have to wait for the next application cycle or get a rejection letter and then have to wait a year or two before you're even allowed to reapply to some of these companies. And so with that, you know, some of the points that I would make are people like Dr. Steven Peskin is available as a career coach and as a mentor. It's a paid service, but if that's something that you're really interested in, some financial investment up front might be well worth a long-term career investment. Some other things, as he's mentioned, also social networking and just talking to people who work in these industries, this is one of the most critical things that you can do. And the trend that I often see is that physicians get so busy and they get so caught up in their work that eventually they get very isolated as they get older, as they get more seasoned and experienced. And you need to try to break out of that isolation if that describes you, and try to reach out, meet people who work in industry, meet people who work in these servicing companies as well, the CROs, the medical education firms, and so forth, and really get an understanding of what the business is day in and day out so that you understand what those jobs entail and what those roles might look like. And unfortunately, we are out of time. We don't have time to take more questions tonight, but what I will say, just to give you a preview for our next call on the 13th of March, is to say that we're going to actually start with a very brief introduction, 10-minute introduction, outlining some of the different career paths specific to those different jobs that we had talked about earlier, and then really leave a lot of time for questions and answers specific to those jobs. So jobs as an MSL, jobs in the contract research organization, jobs in pharmacovigilance, and so forth. I would encourage you to sign up early. We're also going to limit that call to 15 people. And we're making this call available as a recording as well. And so you can tell your friends, your colleagues about this call. If they missed this call, they can purchase the recording. But with that, we want to thank you for participating. And unfortunately, you know, we did run out of time. And Stephen, I don't know if you have any concluding comments
or remarks. Yeah, just one other thing, Joe. The hundreds of hours that we all invested to get an A in organic chemistry so we could get into medical school, the hundreds of hours we invested in biochemistry and histology and in the anatomy lab, you know, it's a different type of investment, but you've got to be prepared to make that investment in this type of activity as well. Everything as painstaking and sometimes painful as resume writing to maybe putting yourself out there with not-for-profit organizations, the ADA, the ACR, the AHA, where you will meet in your local or regional chapters, honestly, people from the pharmaceutical industry, because they want to be there because it's the right thing to do, and I mean that in a multi-leveled way of the right thing to do. And so those kinds of opportunities where you have to rub elbows with and get to know in some different settings individuals who might be your future peer, your future boss, or your future subordinate, you know, these are the kinds of things that physicians are oftentimes not very good at. You know, don't get involved with the Rotary or the Chamber of Commerce and stuff like that. They're out there slogging through, you know, hundreds of patients a week and charts and OSHA and JCO and so forth. But it's a whole different set of skills that you need to develop or that many people need to develop in order to be make the move into industry.
Absolutely. Well, thank you again, Stephen, for joining us tonight, and we look forward to speaking with you again on March 13th. And for those of you on the call, please continue to follow nonclinicaljobs.com as we post an update about that conference call on the 13th. And with that, thank you again for joining us, and you all have my email address. If you have any other specific questions, please send me an email. I'll do my best to respond. And with that, we want to thank you and wish you all a good night. Bye-bye.
Good night.
Good night, everyone. Thank you.
Bye-bye.